First of all, I want to tell you that apparently this book that I have referred to somewhat, and which has the chapter about language in the courtroom and things on language and politics, an analysis of one of Ronald Reagan's speeches and how it uses we and them and some interesting things like that. This is now in the bookstore. It's by Robin Lakoff, a linguist from Berkeley. And it's in places, it's heavy going, but you might take a look at it if you're interested. Today, we won't leave the whole issue of language and power behind entirely, but we want to go on and talk about a little bit about language as a reflection of identity. And on several different levels, there's the issue of cultural identity. Why do we not talk the same way as the Queen of England does? Indeed, does anybody talk the same way as the Queen of England? And why, for example, if you look at it at the social level, why people who tend to belong to the same group also try to talk like each other? You know, sort of, if you can think of it, the gang, you know, if you have a bunch of friends, your old gang, you tend to have the same speech conventions, conversational styles, or at least you know each other's conversational style. And then on a very personal level, how is it that you talk the particular way you talk, which might be different from the next person? It's funny how we all talk differently, but we all understand each other. And if you think about it, remember the other night, Daryl from Australia did the Vespers. How many of you had some problems understanding Daryl?
I had trouble hearing. It wasn't the accent only, it was the volume.
Yes, that. But of course, when someone's pronunciation is different from yours, the lower the volume, the harder it is to decipher it. So, the thing is, though, that Australians, aside from a, you know, few strange words like billabong and things like that, in general, you know, are perfectly understandable to us once we get past the pronunciation differences, right? But why do they speak that way instead of the way we talk? It's all English, after all, isn't it? In Vancouver, we have a phenomenon where we have a lot of new people from Hong Kong. And people have the misimpression, the impression that, gee, they must have just learned English because they speak with a very noticeable, what people in Vancouver consider a Chinese accent. In fact, however, they're native speakers of English. They learned this English from the time they were children. It's just different in Hong Kong.
Are these people leaving before China takes over? Is
that... Oh yes, Vancouver has a big...
Yeah. And are they mostly coming to Canada?
I would say one of the biggest destinations for people leaving Hong Kong is Vancouver. It's done amazing things to the housing market in certain areas where there are agents who are working in some neighborhoods directly with Hong Kong agents, and people are selling real estate and the prices are just skyrocketing. Real estate in Hong Kong is extremely high. There are widows who are suddenly waking up and realizing that the little two-bedroom condo they've owned for 35 years is worth $1 million. You know, and you can imagine what kind of enormous house that can buy in Vancouver. And so they come over with the entire family, you know, and that's the sort of thing that's happening. So that we have many layers, and this is perhaps interesting as far as what we're talking about here, cultural identity. We have many layers of Chinese culture in Vancouver. We have what we call the old Vancouver Chinese who came over to work on the railroad, like the ones who came to California over 100 years ago. it's very interesting how the kind of social pecking order is. You know, the old Vancouver Chinese families are sort of looking a little bit down their nose at all these newcomers from Hong Kong, although the newcomers from Hong Kong, by and large, are very wealthy. And then there are a few small groups, mainland Chinese and some Taiwanese, who and then there's a not insignificant bunch of Singaporeans, and they're all kind of the other two groups look a little bit down their nose at them. It's a very interesting dynamic as far as that goes, and it's very interesting linguistically, of course, because in Hong Kong they speak a variety of Cantonese, but the Chinese of the immigrants of 100 years ago is also Cantonese, but it's quaint, shall we say, by today's standards, because it's older. And so they very quickly they can tell which category they belong to by how they speak. Everybody, of course, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but most people who are, say, in business or something, also speak Mandarin. And there's a little bit of the same sort of social, hierarchy based on how well you speak Mandarin, which sort of accent in Mandarin you have, and so forth. So there's a real complex dynamic that has to do with the language in this sort of cultural circles.
They're not that different in color.
You can tell, I think, in many ways the long time Vancouver population, they're much more westernized in their dress. I think the more recent Hong Kong people tend to be more formal, right? They dress up more. You know, it's much more noticeable. You see someone very dressed up and all with, you know, full set of makeup and everything, you figure they might be a Hong Kong person rather than your neighbor down the street.
In San Francisco, I'm seeing some of the women that still dress like they did in the 1950s, very prim and proper with
yes.
Suits.
Mm-hmm. And that's yeah. But all of those things that we just talked about have to do with your cultural identity. You know, what group do you associate yourself with, and how do you advertise this? And of course, we think in terms of English, we think in terms of accent. You know, there are different accents. We can tell when somebody's from Georgia, or from England, or from Australia, and that's a diagnostic that we use. But it's interesting to think back a little bit now of how all this comes to be. How is it that you get this particular linguistic identity that, in a sense, can give away where you come from or who you belong to, in a sense? And within society as well, I was talking about pecking orders. You know, in England in particular, your accent has a lot to do with other people's assessment of where you belong in society. And for a long time, one of the purposes of a good Cambridge education was to make sure that you came out talking just right. I have a colleague who's really, he's Welsh, but he went to Cambridge and that ironed out his accent real good. But if you're from Liverpool and you come in talking Liverpudlian, why, people immediately know, well, you must be one of those factory workers from Liverpool or something like that. So where you belong among the people you belong to, where you belong among your people, is also something that is shown from the way you speak. Personally, too, we've seen in conversations, on a personal level, the way you speak reveals some things about your attitudes and intentions. So that, in a sense, your language is very much a reflection of who you are and where you fit into things. And of course, on a much larger scale that belongs on that cultural level, we also remember that we don't speak like a Maasai tribesman either. And there are some 4,000 different languages in the world, so we have to think a little bit on a global scale of where a particular language fits into the scheme of things. And some languages, you know, have as few as a couple of hundred speakers. And they're perfectly vibrant and vital languages that are not, they're doing just fine, thank you. Others, like Chinese and English, have hundreds and hundreds of millions of speakers. And there's quite a discrepancy there. You know, what's happening there? Tomorrow I'm going to talk a little bit more about that and talk about other languages besides English and what's happening to the sort of language ecology of the world right now. But for now, let's take a look at some of these issues about how we use language and how it reflects things about us. In a minute, we're going to have some chance for discussion, but there is one thing I wanted to bring up at the beginning, and it's a common thing that comes up in this area, and linguists have, to some extent, been responsible for it, because there's been a long history of the discussion about the relationship between your worldview and your language. And so there's the common example of, well, Eskimos are perfectly adapted to live in the Arctic because they have, and the estimates vary from 8 to 40 different words for snow. But there is this notion that somehow your language shapes the way you view the world. I've already made a kind of presumption here. I said that, you know, your language is a reflection of who you are, but actually it goes the other way. The fact that Eskimos have or need 8 to 40 different words for snow comes from the fact that they live with it all the time. And anybody here a skier? Do you distinguish between kinds of snow? A good skier, you know, can probably come up with maybe half a dozen different kinds of snow to talk about. It's just that we don't have a simple word for it necessarily. We don't have a separate word. We have a more generic word, snow, but you can talk about different kinds of snow if you need to. And this is very characteristic of languages, particularly a language like English, which has been through its history very adaptable. We've been very ready to incorporate new things into the language. The vocabulary has grown enormously. How many words do you think there are in the English language? Well, estimates go there are probably 500,000 of them. If you take out all of the chemical names and the other scientific terms that have just been invented because scientists need to talk about chemicals and other things, and plants, and they make stuff out of Latin pieces and so forth. If you take all those out, there may be 100,000 very useful words. So that's a very large vocabulary. Of course, we don't know any. We generally know a fairly small fraction of that, and actually use a fairly short list of everyday things. But that adaptability is driven by whatever it is we need to talk about. So if we need to talk about something, we'll come up with words for it. If we need to talk in certain ways, we will find ways of doing it. And that is typical not of English, but of any language. If a language is very stable, goes on from generation to generation with very much the same vocabulary, what that is a reflection of is that society is very stable. They keep doing the same things generation after generation. And you see that in some of the native societies that have been virtually untouched by the outside world. They have carried on the same way, perhaps for centuries. And consequently, they don't need to invent new words or have, there's not a whole lot of change that goes on. Okay, well, let's start a little bit with the personal things. What do you think shaped the particular way you talk?
Well, your parents taught you.
Well, there's We immediately know who to blame, don't we? Well, for one thing, that's an immediate explanation of why it is we all speak English.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
All right,
the way your friends talk. In fact, your parents are your first influences, the language of the home. But very quickly, certainly by the time school starts, you notice that kids key off not of their parents anymore, but the other kids. And if you look at my two older sons' history, they were born in Germany. And up till the time the oldest one was 4 or 5, they spoke German, English interchangeably, you know. They'd play with kids, speak German. They would even speak German to each other. But when we came back to North America, I remember the day it happened in a supermarket in Connecticut. They were standing there with their mouths open watching two kids speak English. Kids speak English. We didn't hear another word of German from them. You know, all of a sudden it was like the green light is on. You can speak English. You know, English isn't just something for adults. You can speak it to kids too. And that's very, very important. And you find out that, for example, in bilingual schools, you discover that you may have rules in the school that in this class we speak English and in this one we speak Spanish or whatever the second language is. But teachers rapidly find out they have no control over what's spoken on the playground. Right? The peer group becomes critically important in determining what the language of choice is. And that seems to be universal. It's every society that does that. And some ethnic traditions where language is very important. Anyone know a Lithuanian or a Latvian family? They are, and Estonians as well, they are known for their efforts to keep their language preserved. And I've known many Lithuanians, Estonians, who recall having been required to speak the language at home. That many times parents in these groups despair at the fact that the children go off and they, you know, as soon as they're out of the house, they never speak another word of Estonian or whatever. And it's just the nature of children and peer groups as they grow up. When they get into the teen years, if you've noticed, this becomes even more flagrant. The desire to actually speak differently than adults. It becomes very pointed. It's one of the things that gives that impression of generation gap. Well, what's going on there is something we have talked about in conversational style, this business of rapport, or translated into group terms, solidarity, right? You are talking to make sure people know that you belong with them. And so, that's how these linguistic conventions get established, you know. It's like the group agrees this is the way we'll talk, and that's how you'll know we're who we are. So, what other influences do you think you've had besides parents in terms of deciding how it is you talk as opposed to
geography, where you were born?
Okay, geography?
Sure, the entire community or the city or the coast on which you live.
Okay. In fact, in linguistics, we talk in social terms about speech communities. Now, speech communities can be geographic. That's why people from Georgia talk that way. There is a geographically delimited speech community. But they can also be established socially. It can be speech communities stacked on top of speech community. And education is one thing, one index of this kind of community. There is, let's say, ordinary everyday speech in a particular community, and then there may be a layer of talk that is typical of people who have a certain minimum level of education. And then if you get into more detailed specifications, there might be speech that you would hear in, say, a university, right? Academic English. Oh, heaven help us, it should become the national standard. I mean, who wants people who talk like books? There is a big difference, you know, between written and the spoken style. There are all kinds of indices you could find that illustrate that difference. Length of sentence. Written sentences are much longer than spoken ones. There are good reasons for that, you know. We have short-term memory that we use in processing language. The short-term memory runs out quickly if someone rambles on with a long sentence. And there are people who speak with long sentences. Yeah.
You think internet and computer world is going to change the way people speak over the next decade?
I think so, yes.
So much communication, computer.
Yeah.
It'll be written through email. I mean, what you'll be reading is what somebody wrote. You'll be writing back and forth, mostly communication.
Yes.
This
business of electronic writing has done, you know, I think what will develop, there'll be certain forms that are used electronically. You know, it's not like suddenly we will take the same style as we used writing letters to write electronic messages. In fact, I know it's different because we constantly use email in my university, and I know that you can get into very telegraphic exchanges, you know, back and forth rapidly, these messages going, and they become very short. This is certainly something, a new area for people to study, to see what kind of discourse is going on there. I know that already in education, people are studying it because they're employing this more and more in teaching, and they're trying to see what the effect of this kind of communication is on composition. They use it, for example, in teaching foreign languages. I know that they use what they call synchronous writing, that is that everybody in the class is writing at the same time and everybody can read everything that everybody writes, so that basically you'll see a sentence go across your screen and then you can sort of chime in too. It's like having a class discussion, except you can have the phenomenon of everybody answering the same question at the same time, and you might get five different answers or something.
And what they're doing that also across the United States is in the colleges. So
yes.
It's not just limited to a college.
That's right. In fact,
a class that includes people here, 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 and here, and then everybody's chiming in all over the United States.
One of the things that the education specialists in foreign language teaching are very pleased with is that this tends to increase the production of individuals, whereas in a class discussion there's only time, you know, for one person to be answering, plus there's all those inhibitions about stepping up and speaking, you know, that this kind of thing causes people to produce more. Well, that's an interesting idea. Are we churning out more words because we do it electronically? Certainly, I think I write more messages to people than I would if I had to write them a letter. So it becomes a very interesting thing about, you know, the social impact of means of producing messages, you know, and just saying things, having your say.
It concerns me a bit because we have... Well, for example, I have a nephew that's worked with computers since he was 5 years old. And that's been his best friend. And he's not very socially adept.
Would you call him the classic nerd? The computer nerd? Yeah.
He can do anything with computers, but, you know, he hasn't spent that much time relating to his peers.
That is a social issue. Now, there is a question there. Did the computers do this, or might he have grown up and found something else that he had more, you know, related to better than people? Sometimes that, you know, it's an open question.
He would have been forced to interrelate with
that, may be.
Because his peers would come over, they spent most of the time at his house on his computer. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he was a little king there showing them all about his computer. I mean, this went on and on and on year after year because they always had the best computer. So, you know, I just really wonder what this might do to our kids over the long run if they don't learn to interrelate with each other face to face very much.
Technology always has raised these questions of how it affects human interaction. Telephone did the same thing. You know? And there are people for whom the telephone is significant. You know, they spend significant amounts of time on the telephone.
Driving, you, I mean, you know, in Houston, there are people with a phone growing out of their ear.
That's right.
But I've seen a lot of people on the road. I'm having this travel up here. I was just talking on the phone. Uh-huh. I don't know what they have to say that's as much.
I know.
But they're there.
Why? I have a question. Why is it that you send more messages electronically than if you had to write a letter? Is it just that you save the step of putting it in an envelope and putting a stamp on it? Is that why is it?
Well, there is the thing of immediacy, but there's the other thing that you get out letterhead and you write a letter. You have this idea of a composition, you know, and it has to have three paragraphs and an ending, and you know, and that's an old form, right? You have a formula. You write a letter. There's more to it than two lines. But an electronic message is two lines, and away it goes. Yes, and you get an immediate response, right?
3 days?
That's how long it takes to sort it. Okay, any other things that people can think of that have influenced their personal way of speaking?
People with whom I have worked over the years.
Okay. In fact, if you think about it, almost any sort of identifiable group with which you could say there is solidarity, you know, that we like to think of ourselves as belonging together, you could possibly find speech conventions, styles, even pronunciation things that you do that is typical of that group.
Probably television has influenced the country too, because everybody in all parts of the country hears the same person speaking, and I think that has had an influence on the language.
Do you think
people in different parts of the country?
You know, well, you know, though, that the people who speak on the TV have been thoroughly sanitized.
Yeah, that's right.
But you can't think that has an influence.
Well, I think there is question as to just how much influence that has, because it might be so much a least common denominator. It's not even interesting to people that it.
I have an opinion. I think that one speech pattern or speech can alter by need of being understood. Like, I grew up in San Francisco, lived there 20 years, but then I began to travel around and lived elsewhere. And when I lived in Europe for like 7-8 years and spoke only with Germans and French people, or again in Korea, I spoke English, but far more slowly and distinctly and clearly so that they understood me. They spoke English, thank God. But I had to be considering the fact that it was their second language.
Mm-hmm.
They appreciated being able to understand me.
Yeah. In fact, when you enter a speech community, one of the things that you as a person do is immediately look to adapt. You don't want to stick out as a sore thumb, unless, of course, it's a kind of community where, say, that your particular regional accent is considered cute or interesting or something like that, in which case you might keep it, right? It's interesting that in Canada, the Quebec accent in French is considered by European French either to be something that they can't stand, you know, they want to clap, or it's cute. You know, oh, isn't that cute? Did you hear that? And so it depends entirely on the reaction of someone from Paris as to how the Quebecois will speak French, you know, and they'll just gaily jabber away in Quebecois if the reaction is, oh, isn't that cute? They might clam up, though, if it's, what horrible French are you speaking, you know, which is quite possible from Parisians. Yes.
It's interesting. I had this experience, and Ruth said to tell it, at a faculty lunch table, and we had some Texans. Mm-hmm. Where you were very sure about their accent, that they had the most accent, identifiable accent. Yeah. And they turned to me and they said, you know who has the most accent in this, at this table? And I said, no. I said, you. You have a Wisconsin accent. And I said, I don't even know that Wisconsinites have an accent. And they said, we can tell where you are from in Wisconsin.
Well, I don't.
And I was in shock.
Well, you know, they are right. I can tell Chicagoans from Detroiters, from Milwaukeeans, from Minneapolis people, and if I get the right words, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you say that big city, the Windy City on the lake?
Chicago.
Yeah, see, you're from Wisconsin. An old Chicagoan would make it very clear that it's Chicago, not Chicago. Don't say Chicago, and from Detroit, Chicago, and a cup of coffee.
Well, it's like Washingtonians, Washington, they're from.
Yes.
Washington, there's
an R. Oh, there are all kinds of things that creep up that become diagnostic for particular regions. There's an Ohio River Valley, an old thing about... they say wash as well, but they also say fish and dish, wash the dishes. That's southern Ohio, southern Indiana in there. You can run into that.
There are a lot of words, city names, for instance. There's a Palestine in Israel, but there's a Palestine in Texas.
Yeah.
And so if you hear somebody pronounce the word, how they pronounce it, tell you whether they know.
Where they're from.
Yeah, in the same way with Jordan is a street, and Jordan is another pronunciation of the same thing in Louisiana.
Yeah.
So it you know, that has a lot of...
And, you know, you live in a town, you call it what you want, right? No matter how you spell it. That's the other thing. Yeah.
Yeah, Tom, how do commentators then that are going across the United States, what do they practice to speak, you know, like here?
Well, what they try to do is they try to wash the regional dialect out entirely. And if they're from Wisconsin, they try to, you know, they look in the dictionary and they try to say it just like it says in the dictionary. And
another case of the United Methodist Church in Alabama was decimated a little over a year ago in Arab, Alabama.
That's right. I know a number of towns named Arab. A-R-A-B, as in Arab, but it's Arab.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, kind of like, that you get on local news sometimes, is in our area, there will be a report of something from Yakult, which is Yakult. And what's the other one that they do? Funny things with
them.
Yeah. Many times there are local names which are perfectly, I mean, everyone who lives there sees no problem with it, but like the city, the suburb of Vancouver I live in is Coquitlam, Coquitlam. And people who come in there, you can tell they're from out of town. They murder it, you know. They just.
I have that Chilean. I got
Chilean. Chilean, yeah. Chilean, yeah. Well, hello, Thomas. I thought you might be back for Mama's hat.
Yeah.
I saw that this morning, and I thought, oh, Deanne will be back for her hat. Yes.
Millie Lacks.
Oh, yes.
Millie Lacks up in Minnesota. Remember Joe Brazy coming to visit, telling me he'd been up to Lake Millie Lacks.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote him, how did they arrive at all these Indian names?
Which is what Lacks is pronouncing.
But if England had no written language, somebody just decided that's what they were saying?
Well, actually, from the very beginning, the first missionaries who came through and so forth began making word lists, and they would write them down somehow. And in fact, many times the spelling was sort of an English approximation. For example, I deal with a group in Kamloops, B.C. The name of the tribe is Shuswap, S-H-U-S-W-A-P, which was the original way it was written down. Well, actually, the way it's said is Shuapmach. But, you know, someone who speaks English and hears that, they say, well, I'll try, you know, and they put a try. And then, of course, once it's written down in English, that's the way English speakers say it. So that these, they're very approximate. And when we look at place names, you find out that they are approximations. There are many French place names in Indiana, for example, particularly along the western edge and into the south. There's a little town, in fact, called Gnawbone, G-N-A-W-B-O-N-E. Now, where did it get that name? Well, it was originally a French name, Narbonne, N-A-R-B-O-N-N-E, which is a big city in France. But that's the way the locals said it, and came time to put up a sign, and they just figured out, well, this is the way, it must be the way it's said, right? Those are called folk etymologies. That is that the local people figure out for themselves how they think this came to be. And there are many, many times, particularly with place names, that this is what happens. There, a local story grows up as to what it is.
There's a place in Alaska called Chicken, Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't chickens or ptarmigans there.
Oh.
But they weren't sure how to spell ptarmigan, so they called it chicken.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing because, I mean, ptarmigan starts with a P. P-T, you know, it's one of those. Okay. Now, we've talked in talking about conversations, how your particular speech style and your conversational style can be used to reflect your attitudes and intentions. Are there any other things about your personal talking you think that influence the way you speak? Okay, we adapt to our audience, whether, for example, we know they're Korean speakers of English and they need to be spoken to more slowly so we can make ourselves understood. It's very much audience dependent. I speak differently when I'm in front of a class than I do out in the hall.
Americans feel that if they're in another country, if they speak loudly, they'll get it.
Yes. Yeah.
They're not always slowly but loudly.
Right.
And they answer back in perfect English.
I have a friend who is a college graduate, and he can mispronounce words. And he's from Houston, instead
he's
of
Oklahoma.
Oh, well.
We're going to have to talk about that. But he's interested in a lot of things, and he reads a lot of things, and he talks about what I call carbohydrates. He calls them carbon hydrates.
Uh-huh.
You know, he will mispronounce a lot. It's a script. But and I will make an effort, and the rest of us will say carbohydrates. Carbohydrates. But it always comes out carbon hydrates. And I think maybe he must have a hearing.
Well, it may not be hearing, but people perceive things differently. And I know someone, for example, who is, he's a linguist. He can learn languages like nothing. He just, he picks up one language after the other. But there is one thing about the way he speaks them. He murders the pronunciation in all of them. He speaks broken English in seven languages. And, And it some people though are very good mimics, you know, the Rich Little type of person. They can hear something and reduplicate it exactly. And that's just a different ability. And we all have differing abilities in that regard, and some people have better ears than others. Your fellow has a tin ear, I think. And it may not be hearing itself, just the hearing, but it may be the perceptual mechanism behind it that decodes all this stuff, too.
I had an interesting experience this winter. I was in Mexico, and my Spanish is very limited. But I could carry on a conversation on a one-to-one basis where we were each speaking carefully and knew some of the rules of grammar, etc. But out in the street when you were just, you know, talking to the, well, of course these were, for some of these people, English was the second language too, because mm-hmm. of other Indian people involved. But I would have real trouble understanding people. And all of a sudden I was in a little shop, and all of a sudden I'm overhearing this Spanish, and it's very clear. I can understand understand it so easily, and I turn around and look at it. It's another American.
Yeah, it's been filtered through English, so it sounds logical to you. Well, are there any other differences? How about, do you talk the same way as a person of the opposite sex? Do you notice any differences between the way men and women talk?
Well, now you're speaking of tremor, or Tim.
Oh, no, there are anything else that could be. Could be. I mean, on average, women's voices are higher. That does make a difference. But what else is there that's different about the way?
I think women use more feeling words, and men use more thinking words.
More action words.
More action
words. Men use fewer adjectives.
More words.
Kind of interesting.
Well, we've... What I think we'll do on this one, I think we have... You know, I can see the wheels are starting to turn. Why don't we have our 40-minute break, and we'll come back. No, I mean break after 40 minutes. Okay. It's actually... It's a 10-minute break after 40 minutes.
We get to choose your... I was in Norway for a while, and the English that I heard was English, not American, that I was surrounded. And I went back on my way home and called British friend, and he just laughed and laughed, and he's like, "Dorothy, you're finally speaking the right kind of English. I just picked it up from hearing it, and I was unaware that I was speaking that way."
Yeah.
Just, and I guess, and you know, the people who are really good at mimicking, I guess that's really what they can do, isn't it?
Yeah. My son is studying in England this year, and he is just a stitch imitating these.
I bet.
Of course, a lot of people get a lot of fun out of mimicking the royal family.
Yes.
Because really, they do speak uniquely.
Oh, it's really fun. It's interesting as you travel to think of the experiences that you have with language.
For a long time, you know, in Europe, the standard has been British
English. Yes.
But it's actually, you know, it's more Catholic than the Pope. It's really a variety of British English. Nobody even speaks.
Yeah.
Particularly now in the Scandinavian countries, students will get a choice. Do you want to do American English or
English?
And in Sweden, for example, where everyone's nuts about movies, and so they see a lot of American English, most of the students are now speaking American English.
Well, I learned Norwegian for my grandmother.
So there's so many reasons.
By just picking it up, my mother was in shock that I could speak any Norwegian. She thought
it's like my wife's kitchen Swedish, you know.
Yeah.
That.
And
it's from being around her grandmother.
That's right. It was the language of the 1850s, the immigrants from that time. They anglicized around that time, but they still, you can still hear it on the street. But when I went to Norway, I was to do some speaking with the Norwegian university women, and they wanted me to speak Norwegian, and I said, oh, no, I wouldn't. Well, I knew that was such poor Norwegian. But some of my really close friends would get to speak, and they would laugh. They would laugh. And I said, you know, I don't want to be so funny. But the taxi drivers, they thought I was wonderful. They could understand all the Norwegian. They would compliment me that I would.
A similar thing happened to my father-in-law. He came to the United States when he was 7, in about 1925.
When I go back to Wisconsin.
And I went back with him once to Sweden. This must have been in the 70s. Early 70s.
These are my kind of people.
And he spoke Swedish, of course, as he had at home with his parents, you know. And his mother was still alive, and they always spoke Swedish. Well, people actually just stopped with because he spoke 50-year-old Swedish.
Yes, right. And you know, it's the same.
Yeah, it was like Rip Van Winkle had come to town or something
yeah,
like that.
Just like that. That's so funny. But in a tough pinch, it works.
It was very interesting, though. You know, he went back to his old, the towns he lived as a child, and he remembered this little store. It was like a little newsstand, tobacco store, candy store. This is where he used to go for his candy when he was a little boy. Well, as these things happen, you know, it was the same old woman sitting behind the counter. You know? He came in speaking this old Swedish and says, I'm little Ole from... And she remembered him. You know, it's just incredible. And then finally he found somebody who talked the same way he did.
Yes.
But, you know, this is the way Europe is. You know, things don't change very fast sometimes.
No. Well, it's interesting to me as I visit, like, Norway... how many American words are in there?
Oh, yeah.
Like mall. I mean, they just call it mall.
Yeah. Well, you
they don't have
copy
a
concept, you just take the word with it. You know?
Yeah, right.
What'd you do?
Fished.
Oh, really?
I would answer that way, and he goes into detail, so.
You must be saying.
Well, of course, it also depends on the subject matter, right?
Yeah. Yes.
But I know this happens when I come home from something, being at somewhere or having a meeting or something, and she asks what happened, and I give her the summary, right? And she wants the blow-by-blow.
Well, that's a pretty good example for me and my husband, too. And he'll go to a meeting, and I'll say, how did it go? And he'll say, fine. End of conversation. What I want to know is what happened.
That's right. Was there something back here?
Well, I think there was a consensus in our group that in terms of the purpose of conversation, that may be a difference. Men's conversation is to convey information, whereas for women it may be for establishing a relationship.
Yes. There we go. Focus on the information. And this is a focus on the relationship that the conversation represents.
This ties into what we were talking about then, which is that men will make a statement, which is not open for discussion, really.
Well, unless you want to confront it directly and say, you're wrong. Right? I mean, it may be open for that kind of discussion. Yeah.
Well, that may be another way of saying it. Another thing came up from the group was that the women wrap their language more, there are more wrappers on their communication, whereas men tend to tell it as it is.
Well, let's put it in more neutral terms. Are you talking about directness and indirectness?
Yes.
Men's speech is more direct. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Let's see, there's a little illustration here I have that comes from this 10 of discussion or conversation book about characterizing some differences. Here's the situation. Dora is feeling comfortable and close to Tom. I don't know Dora, so it's not me. She settles into a chair after dinner and begins to tell him about a problem at work. She expects him to do what? To ask questions about it, to show he's interested, reassure her that he understands, and that what she feels is normal, and return the intimacy by telling her a problem of his. Instead, what does Tom do? Well, he sidetracks her story, cracks jokes about it, questions her interpretation of the problem, and gives her advice on how to solve it and avoid such things in the future. Does that sound familiar? Right? Information, problem solving, directness, and those things. Yes?
A whole book on the bestseller list has been written is specifically about that. Men are from Mars.
Right.
From Mars.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I think there's sort of a cultural thing. Women stay at home, take care of kids, at least in our experience. I've been a professional working daily,
yes,
dealing with people and so on, and suddenly have a baby. Now, for the next 20 years, I'm home with little kids.
Right.
And so when I do get with grown-ups, I like to interact. He's been with people all day, 10 to 15 hours a day, listening to their problems and talk. And he comes home and he wants to just sit and read the paper or maybe play a little with the kids, but he doesn't want to hear about all my problems all day. And it got to a point where I could hardly talk to grown-ups. I mean, I have 3 little kids at home between, let's say, 1 and 5 years old. All I could talk was toddler talk.
Yes.
So then when I did get with other people, it was, you know, like being let out of prison, but you don't quite know what to say.
Right.
You're not up on the latest news. You haven't had time to read the paper or watch TV.
That's right. And if you... It isn't just done individually, too. It's a cultural thing that our culture assumes that these are the different roles of men and women, and so we have gotten in the habit over generations of, in fact, bringing up girls to fill this particular role linguistically, and men, the boys, to fill the other one, you know. So, to a certain extent, this stuff gets ingrained in the way children are raised.
But isn't that changing now with the...
Well, I was going to ask that.
Yeah.
You know, think, how do powerful women speak?
Like men.
You know, executives, women executives who are in charge, you know, they're... some of the linguists who've studied this have said, well, women like this are bilingual. They speak women's speech, and then they have to learn the second language too, because, and furthermore, in many contexts, they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. Because the company doesn't want someone who comes in and talks like a woman. They want someone. But then the coworkers kind of resent her that, well, she's pushy. You know, that's the impression people have. A woman who talks like a man is pushy.
And she doesn't hear her cry.
I think this also comes out of women hanging out with women a lot and then hanging out with men a lot. And so there's a kind of code of, you know, of how men talk and how women talk. And we were talking about, in terms of just what I was trying to say before, is that women tend to, you know, often refer to their feelings. You know, I'm sad, I'm happy, you know. And Andy, you know, was saying for men, if a man says I'm sad, that's sort of perceived as weakness and whining and complaining. And so, you know, men learn real quickly, you don't go around saying I'm sad today, you know, that's not typical male talk. And so I think that's also breaking down. I mean, now men are having support groups where they're learning to talk about their feelings.
Yeah.
You know, and so that there's beginning to become more of a sense that we need to share this language.
But these conventions don't change overnight, is the thing.
It's a difficult
thing. You speak of conventions about expectations, I guess. You can't wait till you're married and 25 years old and the car breaks down and then you start to decide who's going to get out and fix it. You know, I mean, somebody has to have some training before that point.
In other words, you...
He knows how he cuts right to the nut.
Well, people fulfill certain roles. And, you know, they have their own expectations and intentions.
Well,
and
but males are taught certain things, and girls are females are taught certain things. You know, and females are taught to cook, and males are taught.
No more.
Well, that's the point. I think
you have to learn something. You can't wait until you're an adult and then start figuring out who's going to do what and then train about it.
Well, that's true, but you could learn to bake.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Pottery, Andy. I need pottery.
Well...